Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to another episode of Quest Youth Radio. And this morning, I'd like to start out by introducing everyone to our program. And our lead-in for this morning starts a little something like this. Lyrics like poetry have a message. History, like a diamond, shines clear to the truth. Words have meaning that we can comprehend like definition. Creating a chain of events to see the real deal, and you will find our Quest moment. Join us and welcome this morning for another perspective from our diaspora. Good morning, everyone. And I'd like to say, simply, a cornucopia of physics dictates that where there is a vibration, there must be a medium. And all vibrations possess a wave nature. You see, in our community, our art is in fact and in spirit the medium through which art waves travel. Where there is no medium, no vibration. Now, this morning, we're going to start out with none other than Mr. Shelton Harris. Good morning, Mr. Harris.
Good morning.
A lovely, beautiful Labor Day weekend, and I'm sure, what did you think about the introduction and lead-in?
It said it all. It said it all, and it was a good start to what we're getting ready to do right now. Because change of events reveals an interpretation of one event to another. Today, I would like to speak on the larger picture. There's only been one season lately. There used to be an agreement between the seasons that they would stay for 3 months and go wherever seasons go whenever they're not around. Lately, there's been no spring, summer, or fall, politically, philosophically, or psychologically. There has only been a season of ice. This season of frozen dreams, frozen nightmares, a season of frozen progress and frozen ideas, frozen aspirations and inspirations. We call this season winter, and this poem I'm going to read today is called Winter in America. From the Indians who welcomed the pilgrims, to the buffalo who once ruled the plains, like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Just like the cities staggered on the coastlines, living in a nation that just can't stand much more, like the forests buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society struggling, but it died in vain. And now democracy is ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops, watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter, winter in America. All of the healers have been killed or betrayed. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting because nobody knows what to save. Save your souls from winter in America. This is one of the favorite poems I heard from one of my favorite poets, Bill Scott Heron. And it says a lot about our current situation.
And just put it in regular terms. What is our present situation?
We're in a real tribal environment where it's us against them. Only amongst the grassroots people, we're the only ones fighting amongst ourselves. The real enemy is the rich and powerful businesses and corporations that actually run this country. So they make it look like it's the middle class and the lower class that are the problems around. And a lot of people looking for leaders kind of fall into that madness that they give us. And nothing is happening. Everything is frozen. Mindset is frozen. Advancement is frozen. And then this is why I picked the Winter in America, because even though this was written almost 50 years ago, it speaks to what's going on now.
Okay, and I would totally agree. Now, before you go to your next segment, I'd like to chime in with another segment and then let you segue into your curtain segment. How about that?
Not a problem.
Well, I'm going to do a diamonds this morning. History is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self. The pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply, my friend, and you are bound to find yourself. You see, diamonds provide an historical method that interprets what has happened and suggests what can happen by providing an historical analysis. You see, only by recognizing yesterday's mistakes can we make corrections today and build a better tomorrow for us all. Because no one knows the path better than those who have walked in it and bared its burden. This morning, our diamond from history, leading poetress, Zora Neale Hurston, who indeed was an American author, anthropologist, and filmmaker. She portrayed radical struggles, racial struggles in the early 1900s in the American South. She published research on Hoodoo, the most popular of her four novels is Their Eyes Were Watching God, published in 1937. Born January 7, 1891, in Alabama, transitioning in 1960 of January 28th. Now, the reason why I chose Zora Neale Hurston is because she is one who has made an indelible mark, literally, with her literature in history, and is someone who is not like a James Baldwin or Langston Hughes, who we always hear or see on the forefront in the field of writing and literature. And that, my friends, is our segment of Diamonds for this morning. Mr. Harris, you have any comments or concerns that you would like to make about Zora Neale Hurston?
You know, only that she is one of the most unsung writers and poetess that's been around. She's exposed a lot of things at a time when those things weren't meant to be exposed. And she was very dynamic in what she said and fearless in how she said it.
Unapologetic, eh?
You got that right.
Yeah, so we definitely love unapologetic. Our love goes out to the ancestry of Zora Neale Hurston this morning. And I'd like to ask you to continue on, my friend, right? I have another segment to follow you up. I know what you have. Go for it, man.
Okay, an exposure and analysis of artists and their work behind the curtain is what Curtains is all about. Because many recording artists and companies have grown rich with support of the community, but have not benefited the community in a lot of ways. In certain sectors of the social world, there are often conversations among the wealthy about old money and new money. Old money has been passed down from several generations through the family line, while new money is acquired in the last couple of generations. While the world of professional athletics share its first generation millionaires, the music industry has not fared bad at all. One person was able to capitalize on the business side of the music industry was a young man named Percy Miller, better known as Master P of No Limit Records. There's no doubt that Master P came from humble beginnings, being reared in projects in the rough part of New Orleans. Fortunately, he understood that while you can't always control your environment, you don't have to become a product of that environment. He began his entrepreneurial journey at the age of 16, selling the latest model cell phones to his classmates in school. He had to take this route because no one would hire him. And another set of skills he believes would serve him well was basketball. He received a $10,000 check as a settlement for malpractice associated with the death of his grandfather, allowing him to fund the next leg of his entrepreneurial odyssey. By the time he was 21 years old, he had founded No Limit Records and Tapes Record Store, where they sold the latest West Coast hip-hop. The store was a success, so much so that it inspired him to start recording his own music, which also was successful at selling. His own independent music was selling at an astronomical rate, so he decided to take the legitimate music hustle back to New Orleans, where he would transition the record store business to become the No Limit Soldiers, a label that ultimately led to a multi-million dollar distribution deal with Universal Records. Because his approach to music was a business mind, he became able to parlay popularity of his music and surge in the popularity of Southern rap into the highest lucrative deal, in which he received then an unheard of $375,000 advance for every album he produced. And the label also received, again, a yet unheard of 75% wholesale price for every song on each album. This was amazing because the standard payout at the time was between 25 and 50%. Most artists had not yet learn the importance of ownership. Master P made sure that he owned every master he produced, meaning that he will earn royalties for that music for the rest of his life, passing that wealth to his progeny. Despite the folding of No Limit Records, the trust it gave for creating Percy Miller has allowed him to amass a net worth in excess of $200 million. With some notable financial publications having given him a net worth even higher. It's been more than a decade since any notable music was released by the label. Miller's ranked as one of the highest, wealthiest rappers in the world. He was able to amass his wealth because he was much more than a rapper. He was a businessman first. He was also a record producer, an actor, filmmaker, investor, and most of all, philanthropist. He receives very little exposure when it comes to his philanthropic endeavors, but he's been very generous with his wealth, investing in inner-city community programs and redevelopment. He also invented success for his progeny, teaching the value of their own personal brand as well as passing along an inexorable drive to be successful. If there's one attribute that set Master P apart from the vast majority of his contemporaries, is his ability and willingness to participate and plan for the future. While most were satisfied with living in the moment, he tried his hands in a number of business endeavors, including launching a travel agency, becoming a sports agent. Currently, he has his hand in gas stations, real estate investments, energy drinks, even a phone sex business. In November 2016, Robert Pack and Percy Miller formed Team Hope, an acronym for helping our players excel. It was the players, or at least 20 at-risk males from the age 12 to 15, chosen from schools in New Orleans, that selected by participants for coaching in particular life matters. Master P has proven without question something good can come out of the worst conditions and thrive. That's our curtains for today.
Okay. You know, I especially like the part about him owning his masters and being able to transfer wealth to his children's children's children. And it seems like he'll be able to make money off of what he's done in his lifetime in perpetuity. Exactly.
That gives me an opportunity to use that word.
Right.
Yeah.
Very smart and young at his time, a businessman. And when we look at advancements for quote unquote what we'll call black people in America, I think he's a shining example of entrepreneurship and what we should be striving for. Would you concur?
No doubt about it. And as you said, he was a young man when he had that mindset. He's only 50 now. And his family, his children's grandchildren are set for life already. But they're still striving to increase that, what we call generational wealth. So pretty soon he'll be having old money. But right now it's new money, and he's doing well with it. Because he understands
right.
that it's not just about me. It's about us. If we're not making it, I'm not making it. And he's parlayed that into a wonderful business, and I wish him all the luck in the world.
Right. Right. And one of the things that I have noticed about him is he is still on the scene trying to help other young artists that are in the business see a clear way and a clear view to follow his path. I've actually seen him, you know, out on social media, and actually, you know, I've seen other young artists speak highly of him. And I would believe that's his way of that has been his way of giving back. Now, what are the chances, what are the odds of me having something that would definitely layer across? Well, today I want to talk about the compilation of a people. You see, today I share with you the Freedmen's Bank, established in 1865. And I think it goes along with our story about Master P. A lot of times we talk about economics, and we talk of, and black people in America, let's just be straight, are looked at as being on the bottom. But the real question is, where would we be today had we had no interference? No interference on the Black Wall Street. No interference on the Freedmen's Bank. The legacy of the Freedmen's Bank serves as a reminder that we must continue striving for greater financial inclusion for all Americans. Now, that's a quote from Jacob Lew. And at this time, he represented the government, and he worked for the United States Treasury. He was the United States Treasury Secretary. Now, the Freedmen's Bank was founded by President Abraham Lincoln. It established the Freedmen's Bank on March 3, 1865, as part of the Freedmen's Bureau. Now, as the Civil War drew to close, the United States Congress and President Lincoln recognized the need. Now, this is very important. They recognized a need to aid the newly freed men and women in the transition to freedom, to support and land grants and other elements of the Freedmen's Bureau's Act. And the Freedmen's Bank was established to help newly freed Americans navigate their financial lives and call it the financial literacy program of its day. Whatever happened to that, Mr. Harris? Let me continue. During its existence, the Freedmen's Bank maintained some 37 offices in 17 states, including the District of Columbia. At its height, the bank had over $57 million in deposits, adjusted, you know, to inflation, and 70,000 depositors. Sounds like, and when we talk, when you know, Mr. Harris, when we talk about this, now I know you're a math man, but when we look at that, those numbers, and we compare, I mean, what would that look like compounded? And give me a guesstimation in today's finance? You have an idea?
It would definitely be in the billions of dollars.
Right.
You know, and it's, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm just circling back to my question that I asked, where would we be had we gone undisturbed?
And that last part of what your statement is really the crux of the whole thing, being undisturbed. We've been disturbed in every positive endeavor that we've ever tried to do. And even with the Freedmen's Bureau, a lot of that money that we were depositing, thinking we were looking forward to something in the future, a lot of that money was stolen, or misappropriated. You can call it what you want, but it wasn't there for us when we really needed it the most. And then as times changed after the little Reconstruction and Jim Crow kicked in, a lot of that money that we invested, and some of us invested every penny we had into that bank for the future, and lost everything.
Right. And so, you know, during that period of time in America, black people weren't making that much money. And to amass that type of financial leverage in the bank, I just want to read a quote as it pertains to the Freedmen's Bank, written by none other than my hero, Frederick Douglass. And it says, the whole thing was beautiful. I had, you know, read of this bank when I lived in Rochester and had indeed been solicited to become one of its trustees. And I had reluctantly consented to do so. But when I came to Washington and saw its magnificent brown storefront, its towering height, its perfect appointments, and the fine display, it made it in a transaction of its business, I felt like the Queen of Sheba when she saw the riches of Solomon, like the Queen of Sheba and the King of Solomon, and the amounts of money half had not been told to me, right? So when Frederick Douglass first was introduced to the Freedmen's Bank, he had no idea that it was an actual building in Washington, D.C., and the structure definitely amazed him. Now, before the bank fell, the Freedmen's Savings Bank had, like I mentioned earlier, 37 branches operating in 17 different states and the District of Columbia, lost a total of $3 million. In the district alone, over 3,000 depositors, both individuals and cultural institutions, lost their savings. Now, while the failure of the Freedmen Bank was tragic and left African Americans with feelings of distrust, I wonder why, of the American banking system, the records created by the bank are a rich source of documentation for black family research for the period immediately following the American Civil War. Now, the records of the 29 branches of the Freedmen's Bank, Savings Bank, including those in Washington, D.C.'s office, still survive today and are searchable in the National Archives. What makes these records so important are the thousands of signatures, cards, that contain personal data about the individual depositor. In addition, the names and ages of depositors and files can contain the place of birth and basically giving us some type of lineage and legacy. And so, you know, when black people are talked about as if we never started to try to amass wealth, as if we had no, you know what, let me just break it down. I'm sick and tired of hearing this nonsense about black people being lazy, okay? Mr. Harris, I'm gonna need you to help me. What is that word when they refer to somebody being lazy or whatever?
What are those derogatory terms?
Well, you know, it's just trying to cast a perception that you don't deserve anything because you're not willing to work for it. But these whole statements about black people being lazy only came after the abolishment of slavery. Because before that, we did everything, and white people did nothing. So who was the lazy people prior to that? You know, so it's really just another way of downgrading and not giving any kind of props to black people from the white society. They just make up their own words, and you say something often enough, people believe it.
Right. Now, on Wednesday, Walter Pierce did a segment on Jane Elliott, and I just want to highlight that. Because, you know, there's so much nonsense on social media, it's ridiculous, right? But, I saw a caption about a woman who was pretending to be black. I want to reiterate for everybody that's listening to this podcast, there's only one race on this planet, and it's the human race. There's no such thing as black people and white people, okay? I am so sick of that nonsense, so sick of it. Yes, there has been a separation using the color consciousness of ignorance, but it's not relevant. It is not relevant. It's only in the minds of those who think it is and believe it is. One person is not better than the other. Mr. Harris, do you want to comment to that? Because I don't know. Am I going off over here? Is what I'm saying relevant? I don't know. I do know.
No, well, as far as that's concerned, you know, when you're a child, you have a child like mine. Like when you go to kindergarten, one of the first things they teach you is how to separate things by different criteria. And as long as you continue to have that child like mine, you're always going to look at things in differences instead of in similarities. True, there is only one race, but as long as we focus on the childlike mentality, we're going to look at the differences in the color, in the age, in the size, and, you know, we like the whole Willie Lynch mentality is that as long as we're looking for differences in people, the people that are in charge know that you're not going to be worried about them stealing all your money. And that was just another way to justify slavery. That was another way to justify, you know, to get the cognitive dissonance out of Christians, so-called Christians at the time, is that, well, these people aren't really human. They're different from us. We're better than them. You know, all of those things come from a control mindset.
Okay. I do believe maybe we can get a teenage perspective on all of, well, not everything. Walter Pierce, our student host, are you now on the line, my brother?
Yes. Good morning, everybody. And basically, like, listening to everything that y'all just been talking about, and I believe it would be good to have somebody of my age perspective on it. So, like, especially when y'all started off with the stereotype of how black people were supposedly called lazy, and so when you mentioned the lazy stereotype, I like how Mr. Harris said that how were we lazy when we were the ones doing everything? We was the ones taking care of all the land, doing all the work so that the white people's lives could be easier. How did that stereotype even come to be? And, you know, I just hear that stereotype a lot today. And being used a lot today on black people, and it's just people just don't understand that. How were we the lazy ones? How were we more lazy? We used to do most of the work. We used the ones who built and took care of this country for them so that they could be living here pretty well off. And, you know, that's just the perspective I got for it. I like what Mr. Harris said about that, his interpretation of it.
Were you able to prepare any type of segment for us ahead of time, or you have anything on tap? What do you have?
So for the first segment I have for today, it is a diamond. And basically, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self and of your mother, the choice of your father, in the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply, and you are bound to find yourself. And see, for today's diamond, the first of two, I'm going to be talking about Charlotte E. Ray, the first black woman lawyer. Charlotte was one of seven children born to Charlotte Augusta Burroughs Ray and the Reverend Charles Bennett Ray. Reverend Ray was a well-known abolitionist and an important contact in the Underground Railroad. As a child, Charlotte attended the Institution for the Education of Colored Youth in Washington, D.C. There, she excelled at her studies, and by 1869, at the age of 19, she was a teacher in the Normal and Preparatory Department at Howard University. While at Howard, Charlotte made good use of her time. She taught day by day and studied law there at night. How honored, proud, and joyful Charlotte must have felt when in February of 1872, she received her law degree from Howard, the first black woman in the United States to obtain that goal. 2 months later, Charlotte must have experienced those feelings again when she became the first woman to be admitted into the bar in Washington, D.C. Now, Charlotte could practice law, and within months of being licensed, she was doing just that. Self-confident and determined, Charlotte took another step forward and opened her own law practice. This time, however, public prejudice worked against her. Although she was an excellent lawyer, she was black and female, and she could not attract enough clients to keep her law practice going. She closed her office. Charlotte continued to serve people through activities and other organizations. In 1876, she attended the annual convention of the National Woman Suffrage Association in New York, and after, in 1895, she became active in the National Association of Colored Women. In 1879, Charlotte returned to New York City, where she taught in the Brooklyn Public Schools. In 1897, she moved to Woodside, Long Island. There, she died at age 60 from acute bronchitis. Although racial and gender prejudice stopped Charlotte from achieving the success as a lawyer that she deserved, her accomplishments served to encourage many other black women to study law.
Okay. Now, what motivated you to choose a lawyer, and more specifically, the first black lawyer?
Yes, and again, I want to give the audience weekly. I want to give them people that they probably have not heard of, and definitely I've never heard of Charlotte E. Ray. And Charlotte E. Ray was even the first black woman lawyer, and she doesn't get a lot of notoriety of her accomplishments. going to Howard University, being very successful in college, being the first woman, not just a black woman, the first woman to be accepted into the bar, and opening her own law firm. And just prejudice, of course, led to her law firm not being successful, which if it just wasn't prejudice, hey, it probably could have been very successful. They said she was a very good lawyer, but she will end up going back and helping her community, teaching and participating in civil rights organizations and women's suffrage organizations to help her people improve and progress in the movement. But sadly, she died early at the age of 60. But, you know, Charlotte, you're right. She was just a great woman and a great role model for a lot of black women lawyers who want to be a lawyer. Just look up the name Charlotte E. Rapp.
You know, you hit on a very important point when you talked about how she came back to her community and became part of the movement to help make a change. And this is, in some aspects, what we're missing today. Many times we have our children educated by the most prestigious colleges in the country, only for them to get a six-figure job in corporate America and basically lose all sense and track of where they came from and where they're going, and by not looking back. And by bringing this to the surface, it helps to cement what this program is really about. It's about giving back, looking back, and helping the community from which you come from, and not just going on life as if you have blinders on. Mr. Harris, you know what the questions are. Do you have a question or a comment pertaining to this particular subject of Walter's or mine?
Well, I mainly just have a comment, you know, and with me being in agreement with both of you, that it's all about giving back. Because Carter G. Woodson once said, if you're not going into higher education to be a positive force within your community, and you're only doing it for individual gain, then you're really wasting your time. You know, because we don't have the legacy yet for us to sit back and just look out for ourselves without putting our whole community in the eyesight of what we're trying to do. And that's, so anybody who understands that you need to learn everything you can and then go back and help the people from your community to do the same thing, you know, whether it's in teaching or just as an inspiration. Because I remember when I was coming up, the doctors lived in our community. The doctor's offices was in their house. You know, the dentist was like around the corner. All these people, because of other governmental situations, were relegated to living amongst the masses. So when we saw somebody who was living kind of swell, he lived right down the street. And he wasn't a drug dealer or whatever. You know, there was doctors, lawyers, dentists that lived in the community with the folks. I'm talking in Newark, right off Central Avenue. You know, but, you know, it's important that we understand that giving back is not only the right thing to do, but it should be our purpose for advancing in the first place.
And, you know, many times, Walter and Mr. Harris, many times, you know, if you don't look back on history, you don't know where in the world you're going. You know, right on Kinney Street, West Kinney Street in the city of Newark, was one of the first black hospitals started in this country by Dr. Kinney. And we did the story on him. And so this where there was a need, you know, invention or necessity is the mother of invention. And we have been creative over and over. But somehow, some way, some of these lessons seem to have been forgotten. Walter, do you have another segment for us?
Yes, and I'll be going into my next diamond of today, which is, Paul Robeson. And as Paul Robeson walked to the stage, the audience rose to his feet with applause. It was their way of saying, welcome home. We love you. The year was 1963. Paul had recently returned to the United States after living in Europe for 5 years. These people had come to show how much they appreciated him. Paul was a singer, actor, scholar, lawyer, humanitarian, and athlete. He spoke several languages. There weren't many things he couldn't do. After graduating from Rutgers University with honors, and he was selected as an All-American football player. His acting career began in 1921 at the Harlem YMCA. A year later, his talent was recognized in the play Emperor Jones. In a few years, Paul was known around the world as a great singer and actor. His rich baritone voice brought joy to millions. Because of his fame, Paul knew many people would listen to him. So he spoke out against racism and injustice he saw in America and the world. Some people tried to silence him. In 1950, the United States government took away his passport. He couldn't perform in other countries, and concert halls in America were closed to him. He was unable to earn a living doing what he loved most, but Paul still spoke out. When the government was forced to give back his passport in 1958, he went to England. He did not return until 1963. Despite many attempts to discredit him, people around the world continue to love and respect Paul Robeson. He will always be remembered as a person who made a great sacrifices to help his fellow man. Thank you.
Okay, so what lessons, if any, what motivated you to choose one of the great in our past from history, Paul Robeson?
Yeah,
he is indeed an inspiration. What motivated you to choose him, brother?
It's a lot of inspirational things that led me to doing Paul Robeson. Mainly, he's from New Jersey, Princeton, New Jersey, our home state, New Jersey, and it's just the amount of things he accomplished that I believe some people don't know, but they know of him, but not of all the things that he has done. Like he was a singer, actor, scholar, lawyer, humanitarian, athlete. He spoke several languages. He did it all, and he knows he could have been making a pretty good money. You know, people was enjoying his content. People was enjoying his performances. So him knowing that, he wanted to use his platform smartly and speak out on issues, racial issues around the world. And, of course, they tried to silence him, and they tried to bring him down. And it's just, that just relates to going back to, like, you're entertained by this man, you love this man, and then once he wants to talk about racial issues going on with his people, now you want to cancel, now you want to shut him up, you don't want him speaking, and that just speaks to your beliefs and your values, that you care nothing about the person. All you want to do is be entertained by them. So you're basically using this guy just for entertainment, and you don't care about anything else about him, how he's doing or how his people are doing. You just want to use it for entertainment. So that's basically what they did. The government took away his visa, took away his passport, and they were then forced to give it back. They had to, and that's when he will speak out. He continued to speak out. He went to England for 5 years. He just didn't back down, and that speaks a lot to Paul Robeson's character because of the amount of money he probably could have been making, but he took that risk by speaking out to help his people and to shed light on issues going on with his people, and that was just great about what Paul Robeson did. Shout out to Paul Robeson.
All right. Mr. Harris, question or comment? And those people on the line, I'm going to chime in after Mr. Harris and ask you, do you have a question or comment? And so please introduce yourself first. And if you're listening, please pay attention now, because after Mr. Harris, I'm going to be chiming in. I'm going to give you about 3 seconds to make a comment, introduce yourself, or ask a question. And if you are slow on the dial, I'm going to keep it moving. Mr. Harris, Paul Robeson, and do you have a question for Mr. Walter Pierce, our student host, or do you have a comment?
Well, both. I would say both. You know, first, again, I agree with everything Walter said about Paul Robeson. He even when he was a football player at Rutgers, he was an All-American. And at that time, at the end of the year, all the All-Americans would take a picture. You know, and he wasn't allowed to be in that picture because he was the only black person out of all the other All-Americans in the country that year. This was in the early 1900s. You know, he also, the reason why they took his passport was because of the whole era of what they call McCarthyism, you know, because he was like people today was looking for an alternative political party to deal with, because the political parties that were already in America weren't helping black people in the sense where we can make any kind of advancement, believe in other people. So he kind of had found interest in the Communist Party, which was down for the workers above the corporations. And during that McCarthy era, a lot of artists have lost their livelihood because of the prejudice and stuff of the people that were trying to keep capitalism going and having the haves and the have-nots. And he was one of the people that chose not to be a have-not. You know, but my question for Walter is that out of the people that you've but if you've been exposed to in your lifetime, who do you think, or is there anyone that is fulfilling that same kind of mindset that Paul Robeson had and when he was out there willing to take that sacrifice?
So I guess I've seen them, probably not met them personally, but there's actually a few people just like them in the NBA who took a number one. They was going to take a huge sacrifice by stepping out and not playing in the NBA until reforms were put out and a change was made and arrests were made. And they made – it was pretty similar to Paul Robeson. They both had a platform, a huge platform, because of their work to watch them. A lot of different ethnicities and different peoples of color, they tuned in to watch them. And so what Paul Robeson and some NBA players did, they both used their platform to speak out and even after the killing of Jacob Blake, they protested the game, they boycotted, and they thought they was going to they was thinking of sitting out the rest of the season. So what I'm saying is they both risk their jobs, their salaries for the same type of cause, them and Paul Robeson, for reforms. They wanted change. They wanted to speak out on racial issues so that people could understand. And again, they both got similar reactions. Even though Paul Robeson's were more harsh, the NBA, you know, you get these comments from these people on the internet and stuff saying that just play basketball, don't get into racial issues. Why are you doing this? And it is because the NBA has a huge platform, and if you want to keep watching the NBA being majority black, it's going to speak on its issues and its communities, and it's going to help its people keep succeeding. That's why they're going to do it. And just because they've made it, they've made millions, doesn't mean that changes who they are deep down inside, and they don't care about the community, because that's exactly what they do. And, you know, I guess that if that answers the question, those are like...
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
About that.
Right. Yep, as I chime in here, right, shut up and play basketball. Shut up. I mean, wait a minute. Shut up. Stop singing. And wait a minute. Keep on singing. Keep on performing. But shut up about the people and the conditions and the pain and suffering. We don't want to hear any of that. Give us your passport. Fortunately, in today's time, they're not able to wreak havoc like they have in the past, ruining people's careers. You know, the thought of reparations just pops all up in my head. The thought of the word segregation and this whole nonsense, as if, you know, you don't owe a people some type of reparation or compensation for the damage that has been done to them over the hundreds of years of black people establishing and building this nation. That being said, I want you to relax. Those people on the line, you are about to become part of our show by simply introducing yourself, and you can please say whether you want to make a comment or have a question. We've covered a number of different topics this morning, one on financial literacy, one on the climate of America today. Is it winter and summer, with Gil Scott Heron spoken about? I'm almost losing. Zora Neale Hurston, a less known poet, black female writer of literature, ahead of her time, who wasn't afraid. We've spoken about the Freedmen's Bank. And with me just running my mouth, it's time for me to bring on the line. Okay, looks like we might have. Okay. I don't know. Is 5671 still on the line? Okay. Is 6139 on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Hello?
Oh, well, good morning. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Bay. It's Tanisha. It's Tanisha Garner. How's everyone doing today?
Great. You have a question or a comment?
So I have a comment. Everything was right on point, and I guess it makes you think about how when you think about the laws of the universe, and one of the laws of the universe is polarity, and when you think about polarity, you think about the negative and the positive. So if you live in this realm where you have negative and positive energy, you always have to put everything back in balance. So I guess, you know, what the Europeans did, or, you know, what the Caucasians did, from a negative aspect, as us as indigenous to this land, we are the positive aspect, and we have to put it back in perpetual balance. So even though there might be inadequacies, it is up to us to always continue to fight and always be able to put that balance. Because, like, for instance, like you said about Paul Robeson, at the end of the day, they had to give it back to him because the universe was working in his favor, and it's about us being united together to always remember that we have the power. And even though they try so hard to knock us down, you know, say negative things, negative will never overpower goodness, and goodness must always remember that and always fight. And that's what I gained from it. And also with winter is a time of hibernation. So even though they say things might die, but it has to be reborn again. And sometimes we have to die in little parts of ourselves to be reborn and to be strengthened. So that's what I wanted to say.
Very good. Ms. Harris, you want to make a comment after that?
No, that's kind of hard to follow. But she's absolutely
oh. Yeah, that definitely on point. I think we have, I don't know, we have 6778. Wait a minute, and let me turn your mic on. My apologies. All right. 6778, would you like to introduce yourself and make a comment or ask a question? Okay, we're going to move right along. Are you there? Walter?
Yes.
Okay, what did
Hello?
You think? You? Yes, yes. What did you think about the caller, Tanisha Gardner?
I didn't expect it, you know. Shout out to her for coming into the show. I appreciate that. And that was some very insightful. That was a very insightful way of thinking about it and thinking about how we all should come together and how we all should just love each other and we should just stop this hate because just hating people is just not going to help. There's no reason to do this. No reason just to keep hating. If we all just accept our mistakes, we could easily move on. So shout out to her again.
Absolutely. I just want to say that the only race is the race for a vision, for a new future, for a better life for us all. And in this race that we've been running as a people here in America, there have been different, I would say, roadblocks set in our way, roadblocks of division, roadblocks of ignorance, roadblocks of bias, roadblocks of color, roadblocks of disinformation, roadblocks of miseducation, many roadblocks to set us purposely back. And I like Tanisha when she says there's a universal law that says that there will be good over evil. And I would like to ask Walter, wait a minute, Mr. Harris, any last words for today's program?
All I can say is that information will take you out of ignorance. Knowledge is power. And as long as we're doing something to increase the information around at least our diaspora, you know, it can only lead to more positive things for us in the future.
Okay. Walter?
Yes, I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. I hope everybody learned something. I've certainly learned something, and that's what we want to continue on this show weekly, learning and teaching. And I hope everybody tunes in on Wednesday for our 15-minute show that we do, and be on the lookout for more content coming your way.
Okay, and I'm going to take us out the way I brought us in, and it's simple. Lyrics like poetry have a message, and history like a diamond shines clear to the truth.
words have meanings that can comprehend like definition, creating a chain of events that we all can understand. We have had an opportunity to pull back the curtain this morning so that we can help you see the real deal. And the real deal, ladies and gentlemen, is to find our quest moment and make waves for the future to come. And we invite you to join us on social media. We are on all platforms so that you can listen to our different perspectives from our diaspora. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, student host, commentator, Mr. Shelton Harris, guest, Tanisha Gardner, and I hope I said your name right. Thank you very much. And until next week, I'm going to say peace. Quest Youth Radio is the best youth radio.